You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Anel Shaleen, Quincy Institute Middle East Research Fellow, on Biden's Yemen policy. Then we'll be talking to Jonathan Geyer, managing editor at the American Prospect, on big tech's relationship with our national security state and the preponderance of consultants that seem to be filling out our national security positions. Meanwhile, one quarter of all U.S. adults now fully vaccinated. However, it's coming at a time when the more virulent and deadly B.1.1.7 variant now dominant in the U.S. Joe Manchin reverses. Now says he won't vote to weaken the filibuster at all. Meanwhile, Biden to announce administrative actions to restrict some guns and gun accoutrement, I guess. State Department says the U.S. is now prepared to lift the sanctions in line with the Iran nuclear deal. Joe Biden releases this corporate tax plan, includes restrictions on offshoring. New Mexico is now the second state to ban qualified immunity. The undocumented win some relief in New York State in the wake of a hunger strike. And a Texas state court opens the eviction floodgates down there. Meanwhile, Joe Biden is being pushed to cancel existing border wall contracts. The Trump Organization hires a criminal defense attorney. That's interesting. And there's a Supreme Court case which could, at the very least, lessen the burden of private student loan debt. And lastly, North Dakota, their Senate passes a ban on mask mandates. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could make it. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How about you, Sam?
I am doing well as well. One quarter of Americans now fully vaccinated, or American adults. You are one of those. But
I am, as of yesterday. So I
got the arm soreness going.
I got the arm soreness, but I have Pfizer, and I'll be honest, I was anticipating worse symptoms. And, you know, I said to Sam, I may not be able to come in today. I feel pretty much fine. So that's encouraging.
Yep. Yeah. Some people have been wiped out on that second shot for a day or so, but it's...
And they said particularly women, which is why I was paying attention to it, but no. So I think it's just very person to person.
There you go. Meanwhile, I mentioned earlier that Joe Manchin had penned an op-ed, I guess it was in the Washington Post, saying that he would not vote to get rid of the filibuster and would not vote to weaken the filibuster. Now, if that feels a little bit like whiplash to you, it's because 2 or 3 weeks ago, he was the one who introduced the idea of the talking filibuster and saying that it should be painful in some way to exercise the filibuster. And that was, and I think most people interpret that as a weakening of the filibuster. So it's unclear exactly what's going on here. This is also coming in the wake of the ruling by the parliamentarian the other day that there's more opportunity for more things to be passed through the reconciliation process, but that apparently is also causing some confusion. So it is unclear exactly where the very slim majority in the Senate for the Democrats stands in terms of passing some of these bills. Joe Manchin seems to think that there's 10 Republican votes for measures to protect voting rights in this country or to diminish the power of corporations on their influence on our elections and our elected leaders. I mean, it seems like it's clear that we don't have 50 Democrats, never mind 10 Republicans for that. But here is Joe Biden yesterday having introduced the infrastructure bill, or at least one tranche of the infrastructure bill, last week. Yesterday, they introduced sort of the corporate tax element of this, which purports to raise $2.5 trillion over the course of 10 years in raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. Still, that would put it 7 percentage points less than it was at the beginning of the Trump administration. And also closing the loopholes that allow major corporations to offshore their profits and escape U.S. taxes by basically saying, we're going to levy a 15% tax on what you tell your investors your profit was, not what you tell the IRS what right. your profits were.
Right. That's probably the more reliable metric.
Indeed. And so here is Joe Biden yesterday being asked or discussing the infrastructure bill. We should say that just before this, a reporter asked him, will you have failed on your promise of bipartisanship if you don't get Republicans on board? The infrastructure bill has 57% support by Republican voters, has 73% support by Americans generally. The reporters are trying to define bipartisanship here in getting 10 Republican senators on board. And that is a framing, I think, that Joe Biden's going to push back against. But here is him response. This is number two on him speaking about the urgency of the infrastructure bill.
So here we are. Democrats and Republicans will have ideas about what they like and what they don't like about our plan. That's a good thing. That's the American way. That's the way democracy works. Debate is welcome. Compromise is inevitable. Changes are certain. In the next few weeks, the Vice President and I will be meeting with Republicans and Democrats to hear from everyone. And we'll be listening. We'll be open to good ideas and good faith negotiations. But here's what we won't be open to. We will not be open to doing nothing. Inaction simply is not an option. Now, since I announced this plan, I've heard from my Republican friends say that many of them say it's too big. They say, why not focus on traditional infrastructure? Fix what we've already got, the roads and the highways that exist and the bridges. I'm happy to have that debate. But I want to tell you my view. We are America. We don't just fix for today. We build for tomorrow. 200 years ago, trains weren't traditional infrastructure either, until America made a choice to lay down tracks across the country. Highways weren't traditional infrastructure until we allowed ourselves to imagine that roads could connect our nation across state lines. The idea of infrastructure has always evolved to meet the aspirations of the American people and their needs. And it's evolving again today. We need to start seeing infrastructure through its effect on the lives of working people in America. What is the foundation today that they need to carve out their place in the middle class, to make it, to live, to go to work, to raise their families with dignity, to ensure that good jobs will be there for their kids, no matter who they are or what zip code they live in?
I'm torn here by the just sheer lunacy of that there's that anybody in Washington, D.C. thinks that that the American public cares about what the definition of infrastructure means.
Apparently Republicans think infrastructure is doing nothing, and Biden thinks infrastructure is something different. I mean, this is what they've been quibbling about for weeks, is what falls under the umbrella of infrastructure as the country collectively falls asleep.
I think it was a tweet by Natalie Church. She's a writer who said that the Republicans define infrastructure as exclusively what exists for commercial purposes, and Democrats seem to be attempting to define infrastructure in terms of like what helps people generally.
Right.
And I think Biden did a good job of at least addressing that and you know, taking it at face value. I happen to be of the mind that the American public doesn't really feel terribly concerned about what the definition of infrastructure is. But I guess if they've got to do this little dance here and say, well, infrastructure means actually what helps people live their daily lives, as opposed to stuff that is like made out of cement, then great. There's going to be this Kabuki theater. Chris Coons, I think, mentioned yesterday that the deadline, and he, of course, was a key Biden surrogate. And just coincidentally also happens to be one of my least favorite senators. He said May was the deadline, or mid-May. So,
well, because, you know, COVID had that the COVID relief package had that self-imposed deadline of March 14th, I believe, before the benefits from the last relief package expired. This is going to be a lot more of an arduous process just based on the fact that it's open-ended.
Right. And so I think the idea is that we're in the period now where there's going to be, 10 Republican senators are going to go to the White House, and they're going to have, coffee and cookies. And then they're going to say, oh, we're close, maybe. And then there's going to be this theater. And then around May, we'll see a reconciliation bill, would be my guess. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Anel Shaleen on Joe Biden's or I should say the Biden administration's Yemen policy. We'll be right back in just a moment. Folks, it's spring. People are getting vaccinated. Maybe you're leaving your house a bit more, going out to eat even. Cautiously, of course. I took Saul out to get a bagel this weekend. We actually sat outside.
Very fun.
At a table. First time in a year that we have actually done that.
That's really nice.
A little nervous. Of course, we have our masks on when we're ordering. Everything, but when it's time to eat, you got to put your mask someplace clean, correct?
Yes.
Where do you do? You shove it in your pocket? Well, let me tell you what I do. I mean, I've had these for a long time. You don't want to put it on the table. You don't want to shove it in your pocket and get it all nasty. You don't want to let whatever is in the air absorbed. Well, that's why I have one of these mask bags. See
mask
this?
Bag.
It's got a little hook on it. It also comes with a lanyard if you want to put around your neck.
That's perfect for your Carhartts.
Yeah. For me, I am a very big, if I could hook something onto my belt then I like to do that. But you keep this mask keep your bag in your mask. Clip it to your keychain or your belt loop or whatever, your backpack if you want. You always have your mask with you. You keep it clean and protected. And I'm also told this is actually stylish. By people.
It is sleek looking.
It is. And this is actually one of the masks I got from Comes in Colors as well. They have a bunch of this is a high quality mask.
All the time. Yeah.
I do wear this all the time. It's got gauze on the inside.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a protective mask, and it's comfortable, and it You can check them out, comesincolors.com. They have all sorts of, like I say, lanyards. They have it different colors, obviously. Comesincolors.com. Check it out for your masks and your very stylish mask bags.
Both stylish.
Mm-hmm. Also, today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Look, stressful time. I've been having acid reflux. And my ear, nose, and throat doctor said it's stress. She said everybody. She said everybody's stressed.
Oh, so you don't need to cut down the coffee anymore?
Well, I got to do that first. I got to cut down on all that stuff. Dang, but she said it's stress. It's stress. Everybody's feeling it. Well, that is why having someone to talk to, a therapist, so important. And a lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. Particularly now, it can take weeks or months before they can see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time. You can do it for any reason. There is no additional charge to do so. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. So they have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area. Of course, everybody's doing remote therapy these days. Sometimes, what we were saying earlier, I do it from this set. It's a little bit awkward.
I asked if I could do it from this set or later today. Yep.
Well, I mean, that's just what's happening. And the other thing that's good about BetterHelp is that their therapists tend to be more affordable than therapists you find through traditional means. So you don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's better, HELP.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the video description if you're watching this on YouTube. You can find it in our podcast description. If you're listening as a podcast, we'll have that URL there, as well as the one from Comes in Colors, so you can get your stylish masks and mask bags. Okay, want to welcome to the program Dr. Anel Shaleen. She is a Quincy Institute Middle East Research Fellow. Dr. Shaleen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So for the sake of folks who may not remember and be aware, tell us first about just the civil war that's been ongoing in Yemen. Why Saudi Arabia got involved, and then what was ostensibly the U.S. foreign policy at that time as to why we as a country sort of, I guess, constructive engagement would be the sort of the most charitable way of referring to it.
Yeah, so the situation in Yemen goes all the way back to the Arab Spring protests in 2011. Unlike Egypt and Tunisia, where the governments fell relatively quickly, in Yemen it dragged out for years. The president Saleh, who had been in charge for decades, really clung to power, and it had he only stepped down much later. And what we've seen subsequently is kind of the ongoing power struggle that has resulted. So at the time, sort of the regional involvement and U.S. involvement was such that Saudi Arabia was involved in trying to negotiate Saleh stepping down through what was known as the GCC initiative, so involving all the members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And that it was through that process that the current president, Hadi, who's in exile in Saudi Arabia, ruling over essentially his hotel room, the level of control, that he's backed up by Saudi Arabia. And so he himself was not elected, but he was the legitimate government put in place as part of this drawn out transition process. And Yemen then had a national dialogue conference, which at the time was seen as a model of an inclusive process to talk about what the future of Yemen would look like, involving women and young people. But it didn't involve everyone. And the Houthis, the Houthi rebel group, also known as Ansar Allah, they in particular were somewhat dissatisfied by the outcomes, which then is part of why they eventually invaded the capital of Sana'a and have subsequently continued to make military advancements. Again, it's been a bit of a back and forth in terms of the territory they control. So on the one hand, you do have a lot of people in Yemen who continue to see the Hadi government as kind of the last point before everything fell apart. And they would like to sort of return to that as a starting place moving forward, whereas others see the Hadi government as fundamentally illegitimate or just as primarily an obstacle to their own objectives. And so that would be, for example, the Houthis, as well as the Southern Transitional Council, which is supported by the UAE, which controls part of the South, although not all of the former South Yemen. So it gets very complicated, and these aren't even all of the main actors involved, but that's some background for sort of why we see such heavy Saudi involvement and support for the government of President Hadi, as well as UAE involvement, although their goals have increasingly sort of diverged from those of Saudi Arabia. The UAE is interested in establishing a presence in the South, because that would then give them, not necessarily that they would invade and take over this territory as their own, but that this a government that was very indebted to them for its very existence would then give them this footprint outside of the Persian Gulf that then reflects sort of the territorial ambitions of Mohammed bin Zayed, the ruler of Abu Dhabi.
What motivates those territorial ambitions? I mean, both from the Saudi perspective. I mean, the Saudis really concerned about their territorial integrity. Is the UAE? I mean, what are these territorial ambitions? What motivates them?
So Saudi Arabia initially was involved because they feared that Iran was helping the Houthis. And what's ironic is at the time that Saudi Arabia invaded or launched military intervention almost exactly 6 years ago in March of 2015, the Iranians were not all that involved. The Houthis had been rebelling against the central government of Yemen. There's a long history there of violence and repression. I mean, the Houthis were targeted with a lot of violence, which they then responded to with violence of their own, as often happens. And so the Saudis worried that the Iranians were helping them, when in fact the result of Saudi intervention has been that the Iranians have seen this as a great opportunity to get the Saudis more and more bogged down in Yemen. And it's not costly for the Iranians to sort of send a few cheap part, they can smuggle them in relatively easily. And then the Houthis themselves have demonstrated a capacity to build upon what the Iranians send them, to kind of develop things themselves. So it's not just that the Iranians are supporting them, but that the Iranians can do so very cheaply, and the Houthis kind of do all the rest.
And the U.S. At one point, as opposed, I guess, during my understanding is that during the Obama administration, the Obama administration perspective was, well, let's engage in this, and that way we can hold some reins over Saudi Arabia.
Well, at the time, it was very motivated by the Obama administration trying to negotiate the Iran deal, the Iran nuclear deal. And they knew the Saudis were not going to be happy with that, in part because the Saudis wanted a deal that addressed other aspects of what Iran was doing around the region. And at the time it was decided that the agreement was just going to focus on the nuclear question, and the hope was they could build on it subsequently. And, you know, obviously instead we saw Trump throwing it out and, you know, the Biden administration now just trying to get back to sort of square one on that. There was a piece from Rob Malley, who's now the special envoy to Iran in foreign affairs, where he expresses a lot of regret about that decision from the Obama administration to not immediately condemn the Saudis and to try to force them to rein in their military action at the time. Because I think just in general, there are a lot of narratives about Yemen right now. There's been a lot of public pressure. We're seeing members of Congress signing onto this letter saying Biden needs to lift the blockade, or pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the blockade, which is accurate. The blockade is directly causing the hundreds of thousands of deaths that we're seeing in Yemen. Many of these are not deaths from kinetic violence, but deaths from the violence of starvation and lack of access to medicine, to fuel, et cetera. But at the same time that we're seeing that narrative pushing against Saudi Arabia, which also plays into certain US political considerations, it's important to keep in mind the Houthis are also very much to blame here, that they're also preventing aid from reaching this population, that they control the territory where the majority of Yemenis live. So when you see these photos of starving Yemenis, that's not just the Saudi blockade, that's also the Houthis not doing more to try to facilitate aid getting to these individuals. And you know, this was initially part of what led to pressure against the Houthis. We saw that, you know, the Trump administration in the final days designated the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, which the Biden administration then lifted. But then that was criticized as kind of losing any sort of leverage that we had against the Houthis. So in general, there are no good actors here. The people, you know, warlords and powerful individuals on the ground are benefiting from the lack of resources and sort of using that to continue to enrich themselves. And almost no one is really looking out for the average Yemeni who is suffering, and many hundreds of thousands of people are dying or at risk of death.
Well, one of those bad actors, though, or one side, is being, you know, financially supported by the United States. So, you know, we cover the United States more frequently than we do international politics. And so I think that's a lot of where our discussion lies. Just turning to how the Biden administration approached this in his first few weeks in office, they said very interestingly, or they parsed their language very carefully, saying that they were going to stop offensive funds to Saudi Arabia. But the reason that this conversation is still being brought about today is that the blockade is technically not a part of offensive operations, right? So the United States is still funding that. Can you expand on why that language was so particular and how that's caused what we're seeing today?
Yes. So the language was very careful, as you noted, because from the Saudis' perspective, everything they're doing is defensive because they see Houthi actions against them as acts of war. The Houthis have fired over 500 sort of missiles and drones. And thus far, that has resulted in, I believe, only a single death in Saudi Arabia. So again, it's the proportionality is really not the same at all when you think about the massive devastation of Saudi airstrikes to the civilian population, to infrastructure, exacerbating all of these problems that we're observing on the ground in Yemen. And you're absolutely right that the U.S. here only has leverage over Saudi Arabia, which is why humanitarian groups and activists really applauded Biden's initial statements. But subsequently, this letter, you know, Congress has asked for more clarification on that. What exactly is meant by offensive operations? What is included in the ban on weapons, or sort of the pause on weapons that are being sold to Saudi Arabia? And what are expectations around that? Could that potentially, you know, many activists would argue the U.S. shouldn't sell any weapons to Saudi Arabia, which I would agree with. But again, the Biden administration has not been particularly forthcoming on that. And my hunch is partly because there was a lot of momentum in Congress around this. I mean, Trump had to exert his veto multiple times against efforts by Congress to either end U.S. support for the war on Yemen or to try to provide some kind of accountability for Saudi Arabia, specifically for the murder of Khashoggi, but also for Yemen. And so Biden knew going in that there was a broad coalition in Congress that was ready to act to perhaps reimpose the War Powers Resolution, to say that the U.S. does not have congressional authority to be engaging militarily at all here. And so it's possible that Biden wanted to move to sort of preempt that. And we have subsequently seen efforts by Congress, this recent letter demanding the U.S. pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the blockade, but not yet moving forward on that War Powers Resolution, which would have much broader implications. And I do think it is very important that Congress reimpose that congressionally mandated authority.
So this is, I mean, so to the extent that the United States has any ability to impact this at this point, we're also looking at, I mean, obviously it's a failure by the Biden administration to exercise any leverage over Saudi Arabia, but it's also a failure of Congress to exercise leverage over the Biden administration here.
Yes. And in general, The Biden administration, I think, feels that they have tried to exert some pressure on Saudi Arabia by pausing these specific weapon sales, by saying they've ended support for offensive military action. And I do think a large part of this also is unfortunately tied up with negotiations with Iran. That from the Iranian perspective, they see the Yemen card as something they know that Biden is interested in resolving or doing something to ameliorate this situation in Yemen. And so the Iranians are hanging on to that for now and not yet doing anything to tell the Houthis, for example, to pause the assault on Madib, which is a key strategic city that thus far remains relatively stable, has actually somewhat prospered under the current context of a lack of centralized government in Yemen, which I think is another important thing to keep in mind here in terms of thinking about the future in Yemen. It is not likely to successfully go back to a centralized system, which historically it never really had. You know, it had been, we can get into more of kind of the Yemeni history, but that under the Saleh government that ruled for several decades, large parts of the country were completely neglected, corruption was rife. Yemen was already categorized as a fragile or failing state before all of this happened, before 2011. And so I think moving forward, it is going to be very important to keep in mind that putting Yemen back together again is unlikely to happen. And we probably will either see an outcome of going back to a north and south Yemen or possibly the emergence of several sort of federated regions.
Which just really benefits, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia, right? If there was to be that sort of factioning, because this essentially is a ground war in terms of both of them gaining influence. I mean, where do the Yemeni people fall in terms of consequences if that were to be the case?
I think what I hear, and some of this I'm basing on a really excellent article, if viewers are interested, written by Nadwa Dawsari for the Arab Center DC, where she talks about the fact that moving forward, it's not probably going to work for Yemen to have this sort of centralized government again, and that it hadn't been working very well for Yemen otherwise. I mean, Yemenis want the conflict to end. They want food and fuel to come back in. But many are very concerned about, you know, Biden potentially just trying to wash his hands of this and leaving the former North Yemen to the Houthis and the former South Yemen to the STC. And, you know, that the Houthis, although they lack the air capacity or the military capacity to exert the same level of devastation that the Saudis do, it's not for want of trying. The Houthis really, you know, are lots of allegations of abuse and torture. Evidence, in fact, of abuse and torture that documented by Human Rights Watch, et cetera. So although the level of devastation coming from Saudi Arabia is much higher, I do think it is important to keep in mind that Yemen won't be resolved if Biden sort of gives the North to the Houthis, that there are many people within Yemen who would reject that and who would continue to fight against them.
So if I understand what you're saying in terms of the relationship with the Iran nuclear deal and what's going on there, that the Biden administration, if I understand what you're saying, then interpreting what has been happening with the nuclear deal is that then the Biden administration was trying to keep Iran's support for the Houthis on the table. And the Iranians were basically saying, like, look, you broke the nuke deal. That was not on the table during that deal. Yesterday, the State Department said, we're going to get rid of the sanctions that are associated with the nuclear deal. We still have other sanctions, but that has to do with other activities that the Iranians are doing. And the Biden administration was hoping to still maintain some leverage in returning to the table. But of course, that was absurd because we need to get back to sort of like baseline, essentially, to start that. And so it's ultimately that the Biden administration does not want this really comes down to us, the Biden administration, the national security state, not wanting to endanger our relationship with Saudi Arabia. And it really, I mean, ultimately, we need to have a fundamental decision as to what that relationship is going to be, isn't it?
Yes. And we saw this, for example, with the release of the Khashoggi report that Biden declined to sanction Mohammed bin Salman, despite that report indicating very clearly that he was, in fact, as was suspected, responsible for the gruesome murder of Khashoggi. I do think it is important. The future of the Middle East is going to be tied to Saudi Arabia. And I do think that, unfortunately, Mohammed bin Salman is not going anywhere. So as awful as we know he is, I think it may be prudent on Biden's part to try to maintain something of a working relationship with him. But I think what he should do is to just give him what he wants. Mohammed bin Salman says he wants more independence. He says he wants Saudi Arabia to be a leader. I think Biden should say, yeah, sure, go for it. We have sold you, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars weapons. And at this point, we are not going to continue to be your security guarantor. And what we observe in the region is Saudi Arabia behaves less aggressively towards adversaries when it doesn't think it has the U.S. to back it up. We saw this after the attacks on the Abqaiq oil facility in September of 2019. The muted response from the Trump administration led to these quiet back channel negotiations where the Saudis said, hey, Iran, we don't actually want to fight this war, right? Yeah. And so as long as the Saudis think that the U.S. is going to back them up, then they're happy to behave aggressively or make aggressive statements towards Iran. So I think in general, in the future, the United States needs to have a much smaller military footprint in the region. And these countries need to make decisions about their behavior towards each other based on their own appetite to absorb the costs of these conflicts, when they don't think it's going to be the U.S. absorbing it, that it is really going to be themselves. So that's why I think Biden needs to be very clear with Mohammed bin Salman that he is, that the blockade must lift. This is unacceptable to sort of bargain with the lives of millions of Yemeni people. And that moving forward, the U.S. is, this is a whole other issue, but the U.S. is transitioning towards China, which I think is problematic in and of itself. And we shouldn't be setting up for a Cold War with China. But the rulers in the region should anticipate that they're going to need to make their decisions about their security based on their own capacity and not this huge military footprint in the region. So while this large footprint remains, Biden should use the pressure that he has, but should also make very clear that over time, the U.S. military footprint is going to go down in the region. We don't need it to be there anymore. We're no longer dependent on oil from the Middle East. And at this point, the U.S. military presence, in my view, is the result of inertia.
Well, a lot of what you said mirrors so much of how the United States relates to Israel as well. I mean, just in terms of emboldening them to take bolder actions via our funds. How does Israel's presence factor into this conflict, specifically related to the Iran deal, which is so central to what we're talking about right now?
Yes. Yeah, so it's been interesting, obviously, since the Abraham Accords to see this rising anti-Iran coalition of Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, et cetera, sort of, and perhaps because there is this anticipated reduction of U.S. force presence in the region, that Israel is building up its strength vis-a-vis Iran. But again, I do think that the U.S. doesn't need to worry about Israel the way it once did. Israel has nukes. Israel has normalized relations with many of its neighbors. And even if they aren't publicly normalized, Israel has a working relationship with many of these countries, including Saudi Arabia. So Israel no longer needs the United States to back it up in the way it once did. And as you said, this perception of the U.S. being kind of the big bully standing behind it, ready to defend it, is part of why we then see Israel taking these more aggressive actions, for example, threatening to annex the West Bank. And so moving forward, the U.S. needs to make sure that our policy towards the region is based on U.S. interests and not on what Israel wants and not on what Saudi Arabia wants, but what actually benefits the United States. And the expenditure and military presence at the moment does not reflect U.S. interests. It reflects an outdated mode of thinking, and it also reflects the interests of the Department of Defense, which wants to maintain a lot, and specifically the Army, that wants to continue to have huge amounts of resources that it has enjoyed for the past several decades, in part because the Navy is going to increasingly get resources as the U.S. finally engages in this so-called pivot to Asia. That's going to involve bolstering the Navy forces, unfortunately. I also think that's problematic, and the U.S. should really be focusing these resources here at home where they're desperately needed. But again, the army anticipates that it's going to lose out in future defense budgets. And so it's trying to argue that, no, we have to maintain now this huge military presence in the Middle East. And also we need to prepare for this so-called Cold War with China. All of it is just about access to resources.
Okay. And so lastly, I hate to use this metaphor, but we as a nation, and we have these internal dynamics that are, sort of incentivizing and pushing this. You say it's inertia, and part of it is like just, some departments want to increase their budgets year over year type of situation. But we're distorting essentially the market, if you will, in that region in terms of like what people think that they can afford to do and not do in certain. All right. Well, so lastly, the other thing that you wrote a piece recently about, it seems like we also have a misinterpretation or misunderstanding of how we are perceived by the Yemenis, and just outline that briefly. And also tell me if you think that's actually like a sincere misinterpretation or if it's just a convenient one because we're not willing to make the actual real hard choices regarding Saudi Arabia. And this is an easier thing to sort of just say, like, we don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, so this specifically gets to when Tim Lender King he's gone on 3 trips to the region since he was appointed in early February. He's trying ostensibly, but then he expressed confusion when the Houthis rejected his proposal for a ceasefire. And I responded to that with some frustration because the Houthis see Lender King and the U.S. as fully on the Saudi side. And so, this American perception that we're coming in as a neutral arbiter, that we can somehow negotiate a ceasefire between these two opposing sides, we're seen as a belligerent. And so we lack credibility coming in from the Houthis' perspective. And this is tying back into this notion of the importance of Iran to all this. But I do think it's important to keep in mind the Houthis are not Iranian puppets. I mean, the Houthis have their own agenda. And even if the U.S. got to a place where we had a functioning relationship with Iran to the extent that we could say, hey, Iran, could you please stop sending so much support to the Houthis? They could do so and the Houthis might not change their behavior at all because the Houthis are largely self-sufficient. They were operating and holding territory long before Iran sort of bolstered the support it was sending them. And they have their own agenda. I mean, they have accomplished all of their gains through war. They have seen no reason to negotiate and no benefits from negotiation. So from their perspective, why would they stop now? They're determined to take the strategic city of Madib, which would give them access to oil resources that they otherwise lack, and would essentially completely obliterate the Hadi government, and it would consolidate their control of the former North Yemen. So again, this just gets to why it is so complicated, because on the one hand, the U.S. is supporting Saudi Arabia's blockade, which is starving Yemenis. But on the other hand, the outcome of the Houthis simply taking over and imposing control is not likely to lead to a peaceful outcome either.
Well, I guess it's not a huge surprise to me, but it is pretty explicitly the same question that we've been basically asking for 20 years. It's like, what is the purpose that we have in being in that region? And the answer ends up being none. And
worse than none, that we contribute to instability, we contribute to these incentives where countries act more violently. I mean, if we could all just rewind to 2015 and if the Obama administration had convinced Saudi Arabia not to intervene at the time, and if Yemen had sort of been kept as a civil war, which it already was, again, not that this would bring peace, but if it could, from my perspective, it's important to get Yemen back to a position where it's not subject to all this foreign intervention, that Yemenis on the ground need to make their decisions based on their own access to resources and their own capacity, as opposed to civil wars that drag on for decades because of the influx of foreign resources. This is why civil wars tend to last so long, is because there's no reason anyone would stop fighting because the money and the guns just keep flowing in.
Dr. Anel Shalein, Quincy Institute Middle East Research Fellow, thank you so much for your time today. We'll link to your pieces, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Jonathan Geyer about those domestic incentives that drive our involvement in places like this. We'll be right back after this. We're back. Joining us now, Jonathan Geyer. He's the managing editor at the American Prospect. Jonathan, welcome. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we were just talking to Anel Shaline about our involvement in the Middle East, and one of the things that came up was the sort of the incentive structure for like the army to stay there so that they can continue to get to build their budget year over year, I guess. And you've written a couple of pieces over the past couple of months about sort of some of the infrastructure that drives, you know, the our expansion, I guess. I mean, you could call it our imperial expansion, and certainly our national security state. And it comes down to money. I mean, basically, it all comes down to money. But let's just take. I want to talk about Jake Sullivan. I also want to talk about Eric Schmidt, though, because I think both of those are at play here. You did an expansive piece on Eric Schmidt and his involvement in the adoption of artificial intelligence for a national security state. And he was sort of working both sides of it. Will you just explain that?
Yeah, it's sort of complex, but let me break it down. So the Google billionaire, Eric Schmidt, is on this government advisory board. It advises Congress and the Pentagon, saying, you know, we need to invest in AI for war. We need machine learning, artificial intelligence, every aspect of defense and intelligence. But he's also investing as part of his venture capital work in the very companies that do this type of work. So it seems like a very obvious conflict of interest to have the chair of the National Artificial Intelligence Board also investing and making money off of these very technologies and making technologies tailor-made for war. So one of these companies I focused on, Rebellion Defense, it seems really cuddly and it's a kind of Star Wars joke, but really this is a revolving door issue. These are all former Pentagon officials who went into the private sector and are just making bank using all their connections. They know how grants and various awards work. These are million or billion dollar projects. And you have this kind of revolving door factor of people making money off their previous government experience, chief among them, Eric Schmidt, a Google billionaire.
And I mean, this dynamic, this is why, you know, we wanted to sort of pair the two of you here today, because this dynamic, when they're telling the army they got to buy this stuff, the army is buying this stuff. And this is basically, it is a self-licking ice cream cone type of situation. And it just is driving these policies that end up leading to the deaths of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And the answer, I mean, this is the thing, and this comes in, this is where, you know, sort of like Jake Sullivan comes in, and you're writing about this notion of like this conflict and this confluence of consultants and academics, and they're wearing all these multiple hats. And there's this sort of the response to the Eric Schmidt thing would be like, well, of course, he's the expert at AI. He's recommending they do it. Why wouldn't he go out and invest in these companies? Because he believes like it's like that's he's showing some integrity in his belief that he's actually willing to put his money where his mouth is on some level. But that's highly problematic.
Well, what I would say is, the kind of corruption, legalized corruption in Washington has got a lot of attention when it comes to the financial sector and not a lot when it comes to national security or foreign policy. So if you're Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, and you were advising Uber, you're advising big banks, you're advising even something funny like the toy company Lego over the past 2 years, it's not immediately clear how it's a conflict of interest, but you know that corporate influence has a huge role in how Biden is staffing this administration. And the place I'm really interested in is the consultancy world, because they're not quite lobbyists. We don't know who they're consulting for. The companies won't talk about it. The consultants won't talk about it. And yet they're cashing in on their recent government experience. And worst of all, from my perspective, advising companies over the last 2 years what a Biden administration or a Democratic administration might do when they're in power. So these represent real conflicts, and they're not exactly borne out. We don't know in the Situation Room how they're borne out, but we know that, you know, many high level Biden officials were working for corporate interests over the past 2 years. That has to affect the way policies are made in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, wherever people have corporate or business interests.
Do you have a sense of what, I mean, what could break this cycle? I mean, short of, you know, that this is endemic to capitalism, that there are there ways in which to sort of like pull this apart in some way, so that those people who are influencing the policy of the United States, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy for that matter, are not doing so because they have a vested interest, or that those interests are even aligned, right? I mean, even if you want to take the most charitable perspective, like, well, I just happen to believe in AI, and so of course I would tell the government to adopt it, and of course, if I have billions of dollars, I'm going to invest in it. But how do you like? What is it? Just simply making ethics rules, or what?
So, I mean, Biden does have the most robust ethics rules to date, but we need radical transparency. We need to go even further. I mean, I got my hands on some documents that showed, you know, an average ethics form for this National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence is maybe 5 to 10 pages. Eric Schmidt's was 37 pages long. That has to be financial entanglements. When someone like a Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, when they make ethical disclosures, they disclose as little as possible. And we could really reform the rules to make sure that there's a wide amount of information about who these people's clients were. And by the way, what were they doing? I reached out to Microsoft, for example, which Jake Sullivan worked for. They didn't want to comment in detail, but it seems to me if you have a Microsoft breach about a month ago and Jake Sullivan is tweeting about it and saying we need to download this Microsoft patch, you have to wonder, is he tweeting as the former advisor to the president of Microsoft or the current advisor to President Biden?
Is the consultant corruption, this new iteration of it, sort of a response to or a rebranding of what we saw get a lot of attention in the Bush administration as the Iraq and Afghanistan wars waged, where it was a lot clearer that these were defense contractors? Now we just have a smarter upgrade to the software, not to use an analogy that's especially relevant to what you're discussing.
Well, there's two crucial points. One is, it's not that the defense industry doesn't need a huge software update. They are behind, and that's true. It just doesn't need to be commercialized, let's say. And second, the corruption I'm talking about, you know, it doesn't compare to the Trump-level swamp where, you know, there are really nasty entanglements. But even so, we ought to hold the Biden administration to a really high standard. And it's not good enough to say you were a consultant, but you're not going to extensively share your clients or exactly what you were doing for them. And there's this whole kind of soft space where, oh, these are AI companies, so that's different than defense. But in fact, they're all working on similar issues. And really, radical disclosure and getting a really deep sense of what Biden officials were working on. 20 Biden officials in his top national security inner circle were working as consultants in the last couple of years. And that has to be very defining of how they see the world.
How many, I mean, so if 20 of them were working as consultants, how many exist? Like, what percentage is that?
I couldn't give you the percentage, Sam, but we're talking about, you know, top people in the National Security Council and the State Department. I'm getting financial disclosures every day from the White House, and I'll say, oh my God, there's another person who was at Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State's firm. It just runs deep. And one of my concerns is people haven't been giving the kind of attention to consulting because it's not lobbying. But we might call it shadow lobbying. They are working for corporations. They're not directly asking government, hey, I'm working for this corporation. Can you help us out policy-wise? But they're doing everything but opening that door. And it's really crucial that we have a deeper understanding of how this whole network of shadow lobbying or consultancies work in the Capitol, in New York, in financial centers across the world.
I can't imagine anyone would disagree with it. We want more transparency, but how does that transparency, how is that transparency leveraged? I mean, it's, you know, like I just, on some level, you know, the, does it make a difference ultimately, or how would it make a difference if there was greater transparency and broader understanding of these dynamics?
So on a really narrow level, if there's a Microsoft breach, you can guard against that if you know Jake Sullivan worked for Microsoft very narrowly by saying, hey, we're not going to have our national security advisor work on this Microsoft breach. But I think it raises bigger questions that, you know, as you know, transparency is not enough to guard against the conceptual issue that if you have 20 people in the National Security Council who are working for private equity and hedge funds, are they doing corporate foreign policy or is it a foreign policy for American people? And the rub here is that what Biden is pushing for is a foreign policy for the middle class, but it sure doesn't square with what a lot of his key personnel were doing in between, you know, in the lead up to this administration.
Well, I mean, he seems to be pushing for, I think, a foreign policy that's in the center of the national security establishment. I mean, like, what has Biden done since entering office that has deviated from the very problematic mean of what foreign policy, the foreign policy blob, as people refer to it as, in Washington has coalesced around?
Well, so far, Biden's really been taking a middle road, and it feels a little bit like inertia. Like when we saw with the attack on Syria, it wasn't the most maximalist attack on Syria. He didn't decide not to do it. With a reprimand to Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, you know, he did go ahead and do some kind of retribution, but it wasn't serious enough to really punish the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. We're kind of seeing Joe Biden, the former Cold Warrior, the former Senate Foreign Relations, you know, triangulator, and someone who really is, you know, we could say responsible for a lot of the great mistakes of the Iraq War, responsible for a lot of mistakes of the Biden administration's middle of the road foreign policy. Now, it's too early to make really clear judgments of how bad or how good, we got to give them a little benefit of the doubt, things could be. But just looking at personnel as policy, I think there's some real concerns about the preponderance of consultants, a defense secretary who was on Raytheon's board, a number of people at the top echelons of power who are deeply connected to corporate influence. And my fear is that that's going to push Biden ever more towards the middle.
Yeah, I think, you know, my sense is that, and they just came out and I think said yesterday that there was no interest. They're not going to even deal with Israel and Palestine. I didn't get the sense that
Venezuela, their position on that, Bolivia.
I get the sense that Joe Biden is like, my administration is not going to be about foreign policy. And it's just going to be on some level like, let's just not do much. And unfortunately, sort of just maintaining this trajectory is problematic because of all this, these type of personnel who fill in these seats. Jonathan Geyer, managing editor at the American Prospect. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you
so much.
All right, folks, that is our time for today. We will be back tomorrow to look back on this week. We will talk more about Joe Manchin and, of course, President Manchin,
Yes.
Domestic president.
And vice president parliamentarian.
Exactly.
Right.
And all this and more. But we will put links to the pieces that both NL Schlein and Jonathan Geyer have written into our description. And we will see you tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, I'm going to skedaddle, and Emma's going to take over and marshal the fun half. And do we have Brandon Sutton's going to be on the fun half today?
Yes.
Got both Matt and Brandon.
Yes.
So we'll have Matt squared, Brandon, Brendan, and Emma.
Emma.
And Emma. Folks, don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You get the free show free of commercials. We still put the links in there. So if you want to find out about, you know, the comes in colors, masks and bags, you can find that in our podcast description. And then you get extra content like the fun half with Brandon Sutton and Matt, Matt Leck, Matt Binder, and Emma Vigeland and Brandon. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out the AM Quickie. And don't forget, Nomi's on vacation, but you go back, check out some of her past interviews on YouTube or Twitch, The Nomi Key Show. And so, Brandon, I want to apologize for apparently what happened last week. There was some type of confusion, and then I lost track, and it was all my fault. And, well, I'm glad you're taking it in stride. I'm glad.
Oh, you mean apologize to me? I thought you were apologizing to the fans. You know, it's big of you to apologize to me, Sam, but you can just apologize to everyone else. I'm quite flexible. I've been stretching for a while.
I've already apologized to the fans yesterday. I apologize to you. Of course, Brandon, the host of what is it, the discourse. And our co-host, I should say. Folks can check that out at the discourse. And Matt, old Matt, what is happening on Doomed?
Well, first I want to say, yeah, last week, boy, I don't know what happened. It's clear that without you, Brendan Finn, this show falls apart. Because, I mean, I just got the Zoom. I got the Zoom link literally after they were already in the fun half.
Wow.
I thought I was being pushed out by Emma and Matt Leck for a second. I wasn't sure if there was some sort of
Thursday coup.
Yeah, the coup didn't hold. We didn't really have the people. So
pretty harsh.
I figured I was ghosted.
This is pretty harsh Matt on Matt violence. That was.
Yeah, well, but
I mean, I raided him later in the evening, so.
Oh, there you go. Matt.
Okay, so you made up for it.
With the 20 people from Left Reckoning's Twitch feed.
Right. No, I'll take it. Every single person counts, you know? That's why tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder, also simultaneously multicast at twitch.tv/Matt Binder, we will be talking. Oh, you know, you might notice nowadays that everyone's talking about boycotts, whether it's the right complaining about cancel culture from the left or the right partaking in their own, AOK type boycotts, you know, when Trump writes a little note saying that, oh, we're not going to drink Coke or shop here or shop there and do this, do that. That's okay, I guess. But anyway, tonight on the show, we're going to look at all that, and we're going to look at the history of boycotts, especially when we go back and think about how the left organized, or how progressives, the broader progressive movement, not just the left, organized in like the mid to early 2000s, sort of, to take on, you know, the Rush Limbaugh boycotts, the Glenn Beck boycotts. We're going to take a look at all that. YouTube.com/Matt Binder, live tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
I hope you're going to cover there were right-wing boycotts, too, then, too. I mean, this idea that somehow the conservatives didn't boycott is absurd.
Right, of course.
We were boycotting supermarkets, the Dixie Chicks, I mean, everybody.
Oh, the Dixie Chicks.
Absolutely.
Matt Leck, what is happening in the Leckian media universe?
Tonight, check out Left Reckoning's YouTube page at 8 Eastern. We're talking to Nathan T. Bernard about the unabashed liberal union basher who was brought up by Maine Medical to stop their nurses from unionizing and why that they should fail. And they kind of are shooting themselves in the foot in a lot of ways. So check that out, the story, 8 Eastern tonight, Left Reckoning. Subscribe on YouTube.
All right. I guess 646-257-3920. You will see these guys in the fun half.
did best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.